Second Treatise of Government by John Locke, first published in 1689. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 17 through 19. Chapter 17. Usurpation. As conquest may be called a foreign usurpation, so usurpation is a kind of domestic conquest. But the equivalence is not exact. A domestic conqueror might have right on his side, but a usurper can never do so, because an action counts as a usurpation only if it involves getting possession of something that someone else has a right to. A usurpation, as such, is a change only in who has the government, not in the forms and rules of the government. If the usurper goes further and extends his power beyond what rightly belonged to the lawful monarchs or governors of the Commonwealth, he is guilty not merely of usurpation, but also of tyranny. The designation of who is to rule is as natural and necessary a part of any lawful government as is the form of the government itself, and is something that was originally established by the people. Compare having no form of government at all with agreeing on a monarchy with no procedure for deciding who shall be monarch. The anarchy will be much alike. Hence all commonwealths, with an established form of government, have rules also for appointing those who are to share in the public authority. Whoever gets into the exercise of any part of the power by ways other than those prescribed by the laws of the community has no right to be obeyed, even if he doesn't change the form of the commonwealth, because he is not the person the laws have appointed, and so not the person the people have consented to. And no such usurper, or anyone whose rule is derived from him, can ever be entitled to his position as ruler, until the people are free to consent, and do consent, to allow and confirm in him the power he has till then usurped. Chapter 18. Tyranny. Whereas usurpation is the exercise of power to which someone else has a right, tyranny is the exercise of power to which nobody can have a right. That is what happens when someone employs the power he has in his hands, not for the good of those who are under it, but for his own private individual advantage. It is what happens when a governor, however entitled he is to govern, is guided not by the law but by his own wants, and his commands and actions are directed not to preserving his subjects' properties, but to satisfying his own ambition, revenge, greed, or any other irregular passion. If you doubt this to be true, or to be reasonable, because it is written by a mere lowly subject, I hope you will take it from the authority of a king. King James I, in his 1603 speech to the Parliament, said this: "And making good laws and constitutions, I will always put the welfare of the public and of the whole commonwealth ahead of any particular and private purposes of mine, because I think that the wealth and welfare of the commonwealth is my greatest welfare and worldly happiness. In this respect, a lawful king sharply differs from a tyrant, for the greatest point of difference between the two is that whereas the proud and ambitious tyrant thinks his kingdom and people are only ordained for satisfying his desires and unreasonable appetites, the righteous and just king acknowledges that he has been given the task of preserving the wealth and property of his people." And in his 1609 speech to the Parliament, he said, "The king binds himself by a double oath to observe the fundamental laws of his kingdom. Just by being a king, he tacitly binds himself to protect not just the people, but also the laws of his kingdom. By his oath, at his coronation, he explicitly binds himself to the same thing. If a king, governing in a settled kingdom, stops ruling according to his laws, he thereby stops being a king, and degenerates into a tyrant." And a little after, "Therefore, all kings who are not tyrants or perjured will be glad to bind themselves within the limits of their laws,
and those who try to persuade them otherwise are vipers, pests, against both the king and the commonwealth."
Thus that learned king, who had a good grasp of concepts, distinguishes king from tyrant through this and this alone. A king limits his power to what the laws allow, and governs for the good of the public, whereas a tyrant puts his own will and appetite ahead of everything. It is a mistake to think that only monarchies can go wrong in this way. Other forms of government are also open to it. Whenever power is put into some hands for the government of the people and the preservation of their properties, and is then diverted from that purpose and used to impoverish, harass, or subdue the people to the arbitrary and irregular commands of those with the power, then that immediately becomes tyranny, whether the power holders are one or many. There was one tyrant at Syracuse, but we read of the 30 tyrants at Athens, and the intolerable government of the 10 men at Rome was no better. Wherever law ends, tyranny begins. If the breach of the law brings harm to someone else, and anyone in authority who exceeds the power given him by the law, using the force at his disposal to do to the subject things that aren't allowed by the law, thereby stops being an officer of the law, and because he acts without authority, he may rightly be opposed, as may any other man who by force invades the right of someone else. This is acknowledged to hold for subordinate officers of the law. Someone authorized to arrest me in the street may be opposed as a thief and a robber if he tries to break into my house to arrest me, even if I know that his legal authority and the arrest warrant in his pocket empower him to arrest me when I'm out of my house. I'd like to know why this should not hold just as well for the highest as well as the lowest ranked officials of government. Is it reasonable that the oldest brother, just because he has most of his father's estate, should thereby have a right to take away any of his younger brother's shares? Or that a rich man who possessed a whole county should get from that a right to seize the cottage and garden of his poor neighbour? Being the lawful owner of great riches, far from being an excuse, let alone a reason, for robbery and oppression, makes it much worse. Well, all of this applies not only to having great wealth, but equally to having great power, which is not an entitlement to help oneself to more, and engage in one's own kind of robbery and oppression. Exceeding the bounds of authority is no more a right in a great officer of government than in a low-level one, no more justifiable in a king than in a constable. It is indeed worse in the king, because more trust has been placed in him. He already has a much greater share than the rest of his brethren, and his education, employment, and counsellors are supposed to have given him more knowledge of the measures of right and wrong. You may want to object. Then, may the commands of a monarch be opposed? May he be resisted whenever anyone finds himself aggrieved and imagines he hasn't been treated rightly? This will unhinge and overturn all systems of administration, leaving us with nothing but anarchy and confusion, instead of government and order. Here is my answer. It is wrong to use force against anything except unjust and unlawful force. Whoever opposes a government for any other reason draws on himself a just condemnation from both God and man. And my philosophy of these matters doesn't bring a threat of danger or confusion, as is often suggested. Here are four observations in support of this. First, in some countries the person of the monarch is sacred, as a matter of law. So whatever he commands or does, his person is still free from all question or violence, not liable to force or to any judicial censure or condemnation. Yet the subjects may oppose the illegal acts of any lower official, or anyone commissioned by the monarch. In those countries, the only way the monarch can lose his personal immunity is by putting himself into a state of war with his people, dissolving the government, and leaving them to the defence that everyone has in the state of nature. When that happens, who can tell how it will all end? In all other cases the sacredness of the monarch's person exempts him, while the government stands, from all violence and harm whatsoever. And this is a wise constitution. For the harm a monarch can do, unaided, is not likely to happen often, or to go very far. Even if some monarch is weak and ill-natured enough to want to do it, he can't by his own personal strength subvert the laws or oppress the body of the people. When a headstrong monarch comes to the throne, he may do some troublesome things, but the disadvantages of those are quite outweighed by the peace of the public and the security of the government that come from having the person of the head of government thus placed out of the reach of danger. For it is safer for the body politic that a few private men should sometimes be in danger of suffering than that the head of the commonwealth should be easily and casually exposed to danger. Second, this privilege of the king's person doesn't confer immunity against questioning, opposition, and resistance for those who use unjust and unlawful force and claim they were commissioned to do this by the king. Here is a plain case of that. Someone has the king's writ to arrest me, this being a full commission from the king, but he can't break into my house to arrest me, or carry out this command of the king's on certain days or in certain places if the law forbids him to, even if the commission doesn't state any such exceptions. If anyone breaks the law, the king's commission doesn't excuse him, for the king has his authority only through the law, so he cannot empower anyone to act against the law. The commission or command of any government official to do something for which he has no authority, whether the official is the king or a constable or anyone in between, is as empty and insignificant as the commission or command of any private man. The only difference between the two is that the official has authority to a certain extent and for certain purposes, while the private man has none. But the restrictions on the official's authority are crucial, because what gives the right of acting is not the commission, but the authority, and there can be no authority against the laws. But when private citizens resist commissioned but unauthorized action by government officials, there is no danger to governor or government, because despite such resistance, there is no threat to the king's person or to his authority. Third, consider now a government in which the person of the ruler is not sacred. My doctrine of the lawfulness of resisting all unlawful exercises of power won't, on every slight occasion, endanger him or disturb the government. For where the injured party can be relieved and his damages made good by appeal to the law, he can't claim a right to use force, which is only to be used when a man is prevented from appealing to the law. No exercise of force by the government counts as hostile if it leaves open the possibility of such an appeal. It is only when force closes that door that it puts the user of it into a state of war, and makes it lawful to resist him. A man with a sword in his hand demands my purse on the highway, when I have almost no money with me. This man I may lawfully kill. To another man I hand £100 to hold while I get off my horse. He then refuses to give it back to me, and draws his sword to defend his possession of it by force if I try to take it back from him. The harm this man does to me may be 100 or even 1,000 times more than the other intended to do to me, and yet I can lawfully kill the one, and cannot so much as hurt the other lawfully. The reason for the difference is obvious. The first man used force, which threatened my life, and I had no time to appeal to the law to make me safe. And once my life was taken, it would have been too late to appeal. The law couldn't restore life to my dead carcass. The loss would have been irreparable. And that is why the law of nature gave me a right to destroy the man who had put himself into a state of war with me, and threatened my destruction. But the second man did not put my life in danger, so I can have the benefit of appealing to the law and getting reparation for my £100 in that way. Fourth, if an official uses his power to maintain his unlawful acts and to obstruct the appeal to law for a remedy, this is manifest tyranny, and there is a right to resist it. But even in cases like this, if the harm is slight, there won't be resistance that will disturb the government. For if the trouble concerns the cases of only a few private men, though they have a right to defend themselves and to recover by force what through unlawful force has been taken from them, they will be disinclined to exercise their right by engaging in a contest in which they are sure to perish. And they are sure to perish, because it is as impossible for a few oppressed men to disturb the government when the nation's people don't think themselves concerned in it, as it is for a raving madman or headstrong malcontent to overturn a well-settled state. The people being no more inclined to follow the oppressed few into a fight and to follow the solitary madman. But suppose these illegal acts have affected the majority of the people, or have affected only a few, but seem to set a dangerous precedent threatening everyone, so that the people are persuaded in their consciences that their laws are in danger and, along with the laws, their estates, liberties, and lives, and perhaps their religion too. When that happens, I don't see how the people can be hindered from resisting the illegal force that has been, or threatens to be, used against them. Such resistance is a difficulty that will confront any government in which the governors have managed to become generally suspected by their people. It is the most dangerous state that governors can possibly put themselves in. But they don't deserve much pity, because the trouble is so easy to avoid. If a governor really does intend the good of his people, and the preservation of them and their laws, the people are bound to see and feel this, just as the children in a family will see that their father loves and takes care of them. But if everyone can see in the government claims of one kind and actions of another, skill employed to evade the law, prerogative employed contrary to its intended purpose, namely to do good to the people, the ministers and lower officers of the law, chosen with an eye to such purposes, and promoted or dismissed according to whether they further or oppose them. Various things done as tryouts of arbitrary power, and favour quietly shown to the religion, though publicly denounced, that is readiest to introduce such power. If a long train of actions show the governmental councils all tending that way, how can a man not be convinced of which way things are going, and look around for some means of saving himself? Suppose you are in a ship whose captain is steering a course towards Algiers, a nest of pirates where many Englishmen are held as slaves. Crosswinds, leaks in his ship, and shortage of men and provisions often force him to head in a different direction. But as soon as the weather and other circumstances allow it, he always turns back on course for Algiers. Won't you conclude that the captain is trying to take you and everyone else in the ship to Algiers? Chapter 19. The Dissolution of Government. Anyone who wants to speak clearly about the dissolution of government ought first to distinguish that from the dissolution of a society. What makes a community, and brings men out of the loose state of nature into one politic society, is the agreement that everyone has with everyone else to come together and act as one body, and so be one distinct commonwealth. When such a union is dissolved, it is almost always through conquest by a foreign force. For when that happens, so that the people can't maintain and support themselves as one unified and independent body, the union constituting that body must necessarily come to an end, returning everyone to the state he was in before, with the liberty to provide for his own safety in some other society, if that is what he wants. Whenever the society is dissolved, it is certain that the government of that society can't survive. Conquerors' swords often cut off governments at the roots, mangling to pieces the societies and separating the subdued or scattered multitude from the protection of the society that ought to have preserved them from violence. This way of dissolving governments is too well known, and too much allowed, for me to need to say anything more about it. It doesn't take much argument to show that when a society is dissolved, its government can't survive, just as the frame of a house can't survive when the materials of it are scattered and dissipated by a whirlwind, or jumbled into a confused heap by an earthquake. Governments can be dissolved not only by being overturned from outside, but also by being dissolved from within. There are two ways for this to happen. The first way is by the legislatures being altered. Civil society is a state of peace among its members. They are kept from the state of war by the provisions they have made for the legislature to act as umpire, ending any conflicts that may arise among them. So it is the legislature that unites the members of a commonwealth, combining them into one coherent living body. It is the soul that gives form, life, and unity to the commonwealth, bringing its various members into relationships of mutual influence, sympathy, and connection. Therefore, when the legislature is broken or dissolved, the society then dissolves and dies, because the essence of the society and its unity consists in its having one will, declared and kept by a legislature established by the majority for that very purpose. The first and fundamental act of a society is the constituting of a legislature. When one or more others take it upon themselves to make laws without being appointed to do so by the people, they are making laws without authority, so the people aren't obliged to obey. And this is a way for them to come again out of subjection, no longer under any government, and be free to constitute for themselves a new legislature as they think best. For they will be entirely at liberty to resist the force of those who try without authority to impose anything upon them. When those whom the society has chosen to declare the public will are excluded from that role, and their place usurped by others who have not been chosen, everyone is free to do what he likes. This is usually brought about by members of the Commonwealth who have some power and misuse it, so it's hard to think about it clearly and know who is to blame for it, unless we know the form of government in which it happens. So let us suppose that the legislature is placed in the agreement of three distinct persons: a single hereditary person, having the constant supreme executive power, and with it the power of convoking and dissolving the other two within certain periods of time; an assembly of hereditary nobility; and an assembly of representatives chosen by the people to serve for limited periods of time. With a government of that form, four things are evident. First, when such a single person, or king, sets up his own arbitrary will in place of the laws, which are the will of the society as declared by the legislature, then the legislature is changed. What makes something the legislature is its issuing rules and laws that are applied and required to be obeyed. So when laws are set up and rules announced and enforced, other than those enacted by the legislature that the society has set up, it is clear that the legislature has been changed. Secondly, when the king prevents the legislature from assembling at its due time, or from acting freely to achieve the purposes for which it was set up, the legislature is altered. What constitutes a legislature is not merely a certain number of men, or a certain number of men meeting together, unless they have the freedom to discuss and enough time to complete the business of the good of the society. When the freedom or the time is taken away or altered, depriving the society of the fruits of the proper exercise of the legislature's power, the legislature is truly altered. He who takes away the freedom or blocks the action of the legislature in its due seasons, in effect, takes away the legislature and puts an end to the government. Thirdly, when, by the arbitrary power of the king, changes are made in who is to vote for the members of the legislature, or in how that vote is to be conducted, without the consent of the people and contrary to their common interests, there again the legislature is altered. For if the voting is done by people other than those whom the society has authorized to vote, or is done in another way than what the society has prescribed, those chosen are not the legislature appointed by the people. Fourthly, if the people are delivered into the subjection of a foreign power, whether by the king or by the legislature, that is certainly a change of the legislature, and thus a dissolution of the government. It is obvious why, in a three-part form of government such as I have supposed, the dissolution of the government in these ways is to be blamed on the king. He has at his disposal the force, the treasure, and the offices of the state, and he may persuade himself, or be flattered by others into thinking, that as the supreme officer of the law, he isn't under any control. Because of all this, he is the only one in a position to make great advances towards such changes of the legislature, with a pretense of lawful authority, and he alone has available to him the means to terrify or suppress any who oppose him, saying that they are factious, seditious, and enemies to the government. In contrast with him, no other part of the legislature or the people as a whole can by themselves try to alter the legislature, except by open and visible rebellion. And when this prevails, it has much the same effects as foreign conquest. Besides, the king in such a form of government has the power of dissolving the other parts of the legislature, thereby turning them into private persons, so they can never in opposition to him, or without his agreement, alter the legislature by a law, his consent being necessary to make any of their decrees valid. But if the other parts of the legislature do in any way contribute to any attempt on the government, and either promote such designs or fail to block them when they could do so, they are guilty of taking part in this, which is certainly the greatest crime men can be guilty of towards one another. There is one more way for such a government to be dissolved, and that is when the king, he who has the supreme executive power, neglects and abandons his function, so that laws that have already been made can no longer be enforced. This is to reduce everything inevitably and immediately to anarchy, and so in effect to dissolve the government. Laws are made not for their own sakes, but so as to serve as the bonds of the society that will keep every part of the body politic in its proper place and function, and they can do that only if they are enforced. When enforcement stops, the government visibly comes to an end, and the people become a confused, disorderly, disconnected multitude. When there is no longer any administration of justice for securing men's rights, and no remaining power within the community to direct the public's force or provide for its necessities, there is certainly no government left. When the laws cannot be applied, it is the same as having no laws, and a government without laws is an absurdity. In cases like these, when the government is dissolved, the people are at liberty to provide for themselves by setting up a new legislature that differs from the previous one, in either its personnel or its structure or both, depending on what the people find to be best for their safety and welfare. For a society can't ever, through someone else's fault, lose its inborn original right to preserve itself, which it can do only through a settled legislature, and a fair and impartial application of the laws the legislature makes. But the state of mankind is not so miserable that they can't use this remedy until it is too late, which is how things would stand if they couldn't work towards a remedy until the government had entirely collapsed. When a government has gone, whether by oppression, trickery, or being handed over to a foreign power, there is no point in telling the people, "You may provide for yourselves by setting up a new legislature." This is only telling them that they may expect relief when it is too late and the evil is past cure, telling them to be slaves first and then to take care of their liberty, telling them, when their chains are on, that they may act like free men. This is mockery rather than relief. Men can never be secure from tyranny if they have no way to escape from it until they are completely under it. And that's why they have not only a right to escape from it, but also a right to prevent it. That brings us to the second way in which governments are dissolved, namely, when legislatures or kings act contrary to their trust. The legislature acts against the trust given to them when they try to invade the property of the subject, and to make themselves, or any part of the community, masters of the lives, liberties, or fortunes of the people, having all of these at the disposal of their will. It can never be supposed to be the will of the society that the legislature should have a power to destroy what everyone aimed to keep safe by entering into society and submitting themselves to legislators of their own making. So when the legislators try to take away and destroy the property of the people, or to reduce them to slavery, they put themselves into a state of war with the people, who are thereby absolved from any further obedience, and are left to the common escape that God has provided for all men against force and violence. They have a right to resume their original natural liberty, and to set up a new legislature to provide for their own safety and security. And what I have said here about the legislature in general holds true also for the supreme executive, the king. He has a double trust put in him, both to have a part in the legislature and to be in charge of the enforcement of the law, and he acts against both when he tries to set up his own arbitrary will as the law of the society. He also acts contrary to his trust when he either employs the force, treasure, and offices of the society to corrupt the representatives and win them over to his schemes, or openly courts the electorate, persuading them to choose the legislators whom he has already won over to his side by persuasion, threats, promises, or whatever, thus getting the electorate to bring in ones who have promised beforehand how they will vote and what legislation they will pass. Regulating candidates and electors in this way, reshaping the electoral procedures, what is this but digging up the government by the roots and poisoning the very fountain of public security? The people kept for themselves the choice of their representatives as the fences around their properties, and the only reason they could have for this was so that the representatives would always be freely chosen and, having been chosen, would freely act and advise in ways that they judged, after examination and mature debate, to be necessary for the commonwealth and the public good. Representatives can't do this if they have given their votes in advance, before hearing the debate and weighing the reasons on all sides. For someone to prepare such a legislative assembly as this, and try to set up the declared supporters of his own will as the true representatives of the people and the lawmakers of the society, is certainly as great a breach of trust and as complete an admission that he plans to subvert the government as could be met with. If there is any doubt as to whether that is what is going on, it will be blown away if rewards and punishments are visibly employed for the same purpose, with all the tricks of perverted law being used to eliminate and destroy all who stand in the way of such a design, and refuse to consent to betraying the liberties of their country. It is easy to see what power in the society ought to be allowed to those who have used their power contrary to the trust with which they were given it. Anyone can see that someone who has once attempted such a thing as this can no longer be trusted with anything. You may want to object. The people are ignorant and always discontented. To base government on their unsteady opinions and uncertain moods is to expose it to certain ruin. No government can last for long if the people can set up a new legislature whenever they take offence at the old one. I answer, quite the contrary. It is harder to get people out of their old forms of government than some writers are apt to suggest. It is almost impossible to get them to amend the admitted faults in the system they have grown used to. And if there are any systemic defects, or less deep ones introduced by decay or by the passage of time, it's hard to get them changed, even when everyone sees an opportunity to do so. This slow reluctance of the people to give up their old constitutions has, in the many revolutions that have occurred in this kingdom recently and in earlier centuries, still kept us to our old legislature of king, lords, and commons. Or, when we didn't keep it, there was a period of fruitless attempts to have a different form of government, after which we returned to the system of king, lords, and commons. And whatever provocations have made the crown be taken from some of our monarchs' heads, they never carried the people so far as to give it to someone who is not in the same line of descent. But, it will be said, this hypothesis creates a ferment for frequent rebellion, to which I have three answers. First, it doesn't do so, more than any other hypothesis does. For when the people are made miserable, and find themselves exposed to mistreatment by arbitrary power, praise their governors as much as you will as sons of Jupiter, let them be sacred and divine, descended from heaven or authorized by it, make them out to be anyone or anything you please, and the same thing will happen. The people who are generally and wrongfully ill-treated will be ready on any occasion to free themselves of a burden that sits heavily on them. They will want an opportunity to do this, and will look for one, and they usually won't have to look for long. Someone who has not seen examples of this in his own lifetime must be very young, and someone who can't cite examples of it in all sorts of governments in the world can't have read much. Secondly, I answer that such revolutions don't happen with every little mismanagement in public affairs. Great mistakes by the rulers, many wrong and inconvenient laws, and all the slips of human frailty, these will be borne by the people without mutiny or murmur. But if a long series of abuses, lies, and tricks, all tending the same way, make the design visible to the people, so that they can't help feeling what they are oppressed by and seeing where they are going, it's not surprising that they should then rouse themselves and try to put the ruling power into hands that will achieve for them the purposes for which government was at first established. Thirdly, to the charge that this hypothesis creates a ferment for frequent rebellion, I answer that, on the contrary, this doctrine giving the people a power to provide anew for their safety by establishing a new legislature, when their legislators have acted contrary to their trust by invading the people's property, is the best barrier to rebellion, and the best means to block it. Here is why. Rebellion is opposition not to persons, but to authority, of which the only basis is the constitutions and laws of the government. So those who by force break through, and by force justify their violation of the constitution and laws, are truly and properly rebels. Those most likely to rebel against the constitution and the laws are those who are in power, because of their claim to authority, because of the temptation of the force at their disposal, and because of the flattery of those around them. And the best way to prevent this evil is to show those likely offenders the danger and injustice of it. Those who say I am laying a foundation for rebellion mean that my doctrine may lead to civil wars or internal unrest. What do they infer from that? I tell the people that they are absolved from obedience when illegal attempts are made upon their liberties or properties, and that they may oppose the unlawful violence of those who were their law officers when they invade their properties contrary to the trust put in them. Do my opponents hold that this doctrine of mine is not to be allowed because it is so destructive to the peace of the world? That would be like saying that honest men may not oppose robbers or pirates because this may lead to disorder or bloodshed. If any harm comes about in such a case, it is not to be charged against him who defends his own right, but against him who attacks his neighbours. The purpose of government is the good of mankind. Which is better for mankind? That the people be always exposed to the limitless will of tyranny, or that the rulers be sometimes liable to meet with opposition when they grow exorbitant in the use of their power and use it for the destruction of their people's properties? Don't say mischief can arise from that whenever it shall please a busy head or turbulent spirit to want to alter the government. Indeed, men like that may stir up trouble whenever they please, but it will only be to their own rightful ruin and perdition. That is because the people, who are more disposed to suffer than to right themselves by resistance, are not likely to rise up until the mischief has become general, and the wicked schemes of the rulers have become visible, or their attempts have been felt in the lives of the majority. The people are not moved by individual examples of injustice, here and there an unfortunate man oppressed. But if they all become convinced on clear evidence that schemes are being launched against their liberties, and the general course and tendency of things forces them to suspect the evil intention of their governors, who is to be blamed for that? I grant that the pride, ambition, and turbulence of private men have sometimes caused great disorders in commonwealths, and factions have been fatal to states and kingdoms. But whether the mischief has oftener begun in the people's irresponsibility, or in the ruler's insolence, I leave to impartial history to decide. I am sure of this, though. Anyone, whether ruler or subject, who by force tries to invade the rights of either monarch or people, and lays the foundation for overturning the constitution and structure of any just government, is highly guilty of the greatest crime a man is capable of. Such a person must answer for all the mischiefs of blood, looting, and desolation that come on a country when its government is broken to pieces. Everyone agrees that ordinary subjects or foreigners who bring force against the properties of any people may be resisted with force. But it has recently been denied that one may resist law officers who do the same thing. As if those to whom the laws give the greatest privileges and advantages are thereby also given a power to break those laws, the very laws that put them in a better place than their brethren. Actually, their privileged position makes their offence even worse. In it they show themselves as ungrateful for the bigger share that the law gives them, and they break the trust that was put into their hands by their brethren. At this point you are likely to ask, who is to be the judge of whether monarchs or legislatures have acted contrary to their trust? That they have so acted is the sort of thing that can be spread around among the people by discontented and factious men, when all the king has done is to make use of his legitimate prerogative. To this I reply, the people should be the judge. For who should judge whether a trustee or deputy has acted well and according to the trust reposed in him, if not the person who deputes him? Having deputed him, he must retain a power to discard him when he fails in his trust. If this is reasonable in particular cases of private men, why should it be otherwise in this most important case, where the welfare of millions is concerned, and where the threatened evil is greater, and redressing it is very difficult, costly, and dangerous? Furthermore, the question, who is to be the judge, can't mean that there is no judge at all. For when there is no judicature on earth to decide controversies among men, God in heaven is the judge. It is true that God alone is the judge of what is right. But every man is judge for himself, in this case as in all others, of whether another man has put himself into a state of war with him, and whether he should appeal to the supreme judge. If a controversy arises between a king and some of the people, in a matter of great importance where the law is silent or doubtful, I think the right umpire would be the body of the people. For in cases where the king has a trust placed in him, and is dispensed from the common ordinary rules of the law, if any private men are aggrieved, and think that the king acts beyond that trust or contrary to it, the body of the people who first placed that trust in him are clearly the best judges of how far they meant the trust to extend. If that way of settling the matter is turned down by the king, or whoever is administering the government, the only court of appeal is in heaven. What we have here is properly a state of war, in which the only appeal is to heaven. And in that state, the injured party must judge for himself when it is fit for him to make such an appeal. To conclude, the power that every individual gave to the society when he entered into it can never revert to the individuals again as long as the society lasts, but will always remain in the community. Because without this, there can't be a community, a commonwealth, and that would be contrary to the original agreement. So too, when the society has placed the legislative power in any assembly of men to continue in them and their successors with direction and authority for providing such successors, the legislative power can never revert to the people while that government lasts, because having provided a legislature with power to continue for ever, they have given to it their political power and cannot get it back. But if they have set limits to the duration of their legislature, and given this supreme power to some person or assembly only temporarily, or if it is forfeited through the misbehaviour of those in authority, at the set time or at the time of the forfeiture, the power does revert to the society, and then the people have a right to act as supreme, and to continue the legislature in themselves, or to set up a new form of government, or retain the old form while placing it in new hands as they see fit. End of chapters 17 through 19. End of the work.